Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to You and Me at 30. I am your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. You and Me at 30 is a new talk show bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussions on a variety of topics. While many of our guests will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature individuals from around the country. Please note that the views and opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. Do you want to be empowered? Do you want to live your best life? Do you want to be resilient? Do you want to be a change maker? Today's guest knows all about those different things, and she's going to help you achieve those goals. Her name is Dr. Christine Grant. Dr. Grant is a tenured full professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering at North Carolina State University. She's been an administrative leader for over 10 years as the Associate Dean of Faculty Advancement in the North Carolina State College of Engineering. She obtained a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from Brown University, has graduate degrees, master's, as well as PhD from Georgia Tech. She joined the faculty at North Carolina State in 1989 and is on her way to 30 years of working at the university. Dr. Grant, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Wright. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. So let's jump right into this. Before we get into, everything that you do within the STEM field and, you know, you've written books and, you have a podcast and you've won numerous awards, and we're definitely going to talk about all of those things. I want our guests and our listeners to know who you are, where you come from. So where were you born?
Born in upstate New York. I was born in Schenectady, New York, and I moved to Albany, New York when I was in, I believe it was about seventh grade, and once I finished my high schooling up in upstate New York, I went to Brown University, and then I went on to Georgia Tech to get my master's and my PhD, and so I'm from the north, but I live in the south, so that's an interesting contrast. And that's how I started.
And did you know from the time you were a little girl that this is the career path you were going to take?
Well, that's really interesting. I knew I loved science, and it turned out that my mother, my late mother, Frances Grant, was a science teacher. She was a biology teacher, and she actually got her degree at State Teachers College in Albany, New York, which was right across the street from my high school, and times changed over the years. She was one of the first African-Americans to go there. She was in a segregated, it was a quota system for her to go to college, and then when she graduated, it was hard for her to get a job in the north, and so she went down south to Florence, South Carolina, and taught in the segregated school system down there. So she was always doing science experiments with me when I was a little girl, and my father was a music teacher, and he was giving piano lessons in the home, so this idea of being a teacher and an educator was not far-fetched. And my mother used to actually do science experiments with us when we were little girls. It was me and my sister. And my dad, actually, because he had no sons, had us doing things, building a boat. He built a boat from the hull up, and then we would do things around the house and just projects. So I guess that was early engineering and early science in my household, actually.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, you have mentioned your mom teaching in these segregated schools. I think about the movie Hidden Figures and how instrumental that was in telling the story of these black women who were pioneers in science at a time when Jim Crow was very prevalent throughout the South. Was it challenging for you as a young girl and eventually a woman of color to go off to Brown University and go off to Georgia Tech and you know, go for a PhD in the STEM field?
It was a challenge for a number of different reasons. I believe that my parents and my grandparents and family instilled in me the importance of education. It turned out that I didn't find out until much later in life that my grandmother and grandfather had not completed high school. I believe my grandmother did eventually. However, I never knew what their background was. I didn't know that they hadn't gone to college. However, they always instilled the importance of education in us, and other family members did as well. And so it was no question that I was going to go to college. That was the expectation. And then I had a number of mentors and folks. I think that some of the programs that they had, Program to Increase Minority Engineering Graduates, sponsored by General Electric, when I was in junior high and high school, actually had us going to visit different campuses or participating in summer programs for minority students who were interested in engineering at UMass Amherst and Northeastern University. So this whole idea of, could you do it? Of course, that was something that was instilled in me from a lot of different places. However, when I got to the university, there were some things I encountered, some faculty who said, oh, maybe you should change your major, when I had some challenges my freshman year in an engineering course. Or, well, I don't know if you want to go to grad school. So there were those voices. However, their other voices were stronger, and my desire to go forward was even stronger. It hasn't been an easy journey. When I finished my PhD and came to North Carolina State as a faculty member, I was the first and only African-American woman in the College of Engineering with over 250 faculty. I was the only one for 16 years. So you can just imagine some of the dynamics associated with that that are the same as a lot of folks have experienced in a number of different fields.
Right. And let's talk about that, because one of the things that I hear from friends of mine who teach at people of color who teach at predominantly white institutions and, you know, universities, is having to face that challenge of sometimes being one of few, and sometimes one of only one, minorities, not just in terms of their faculty and the people they're working with, but also when they step into that classroom, they have students who may not be accustomed to having, you know, let's just be clear, you know, a black woman teaching them. And some of those students don't always take them seriously, or they feel as though they have to go an extra mile just to prove their credentials or to prove that they're knowledgeable of the content they're delivering to their students. So for you early on, because you said, you know, you were one of one for 16 years, you're at a school in the South, in North Carolina. How challenging was that, being like the only black woman teaching engineering to the students?
It was a challenge. There were people in the department who were very supportive and mentored me. There were faculty who were very supportive and mentored me. There were faculty who were not so supportive, and in subtle ways, you know, there's this term called unconscious bias or microaggressions. I know those terms now and I understand what they mean. Unconscious bias is kind of this unconscious bias you might have towards someone, and we all have that. Microaggressions are things that you do, little things you do to kind of pick at people, maybe making jokes or saying little snide remarks or things like that. So you would face that in the classroom sometimes, in office hours with students. I would say, generally speaking, the students were very nice, very humble, and wanting to learn. I think that the thing that I saw changing over the years was this attitude of teach me, I dare you, from some of the students, because it became one of these, became kind of a buyer's market, right, where students want to be serviced by their faculty in terms of delivering content, and they think that they're this consumer and that you're supposed to kind of do what they need you to do, so to speak. So that's the shift I saw over a number of years that I was a faculty member. However, there were people who were very supportive, and then there were people who were not so supportive. I remember going to a conference and meeting a man who looked like he was Indian from India, and he was actually African American. And he told me he had been at a conference with one of my colleagues who said, oh, she only got hired because she was black, and had said all kinds of things about me. Didn't know that this guy was African American, and eventually I would meet him at a conference and he would tell me that. And so I had to come back to my institution, and I couldn't say anything. At the same time, there were people who were very supportive, took me under their wing, and I co-advised graduate students with them, co-taught with them, and were very supportive. So it kind of varied. So one question you might think about is, so how did you survive that? What did you do? I had a network of people within the university, initially African-American women from English and history and a lot of different places that were my allies and supporters that I could get encouragement and feel empowered from to assist me.
What do you know by any chance the numbers in terms of like what the percentages are with right now in terms of women in STEM, women in general, and then like minority women? Would you happen to know that?
I don't know them off the top of my head. I would say that they are in the single or low double digits, depending on the field. Okay. I know in my field, chemical engineering, for women, actually our field has sometimes upwards of 30-40% women in the undergraduate classes. Now, when you move to the graduate level and then to the faculty level, those numbers decrease significantly. And so, for example, in my college, we have about 350 faculty. This would be tenure and tenure track. And we may have 50 women, and that might be tenure and non-tenure track faculty. Again, I can't recall the numbers off the top of my head, but it is very small. It's not 50-50. So you see a drop-off over time, or I'm sorry, you see a drop-off as the rank changes, as you move up the rank.
Do you believe that's just because women, for the most part, aren't encouraged at a younger age to really go into those fields?
I think it's very complex. I believe that, you know, there are a lot of studies that have been done on women being interested in science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM fields early on, and then something happens when they're either before they turn 10 years old or when they're preteen, where they're discouraged, or, you know, in terms of the norms, the cultural norms as to what women should be studying, what they should be doing. I think that's a challenge. I think that when they get into the university, that there's unconscious bias, there's direct bias, there's sexism, there's racism, all kinds of things that are going on that are really subtle that discourage women from being in the field. I think having a supportive network of mentors and coaches and seeing people who look like them. So, for example, I never saw an African-American woman engineering faculty until I got to graduate school at Georgia Tech, and there was one, and she was very encouraging. However, I think seeing yourself in the field or in the faculty is really critical, and that's why organizations like the National Society of Black Engineers, the Society of Women Engineers, that have conferences with, you know, 10, 20,000 folks that are going to these conferences to see women engineers that look like them or African-American engineers that look like them and forming these cohorts is really important. So there's a couple of ways that people approach it. One is to set up interventions like programs to help students to be more successful, to train them. And then there has to be infrastructure change. There has to be institutional transformation where the institutions become more amenable to these communities and become aware of these biases that may exist in their institutions and figure out ways and techniques to mitigate those biases so that you don't have those discrepancies in the numbers and the success rate.
Right. I think back to, I think it was 2005 when the former president of Harvard University, Lawrence Summers, had made that statement about women being poor at science and math. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. I think there's a lot of things that are said in public forums like that one and in private conference rooms and private boardrooms, right? And the challenge is when you take those statements and you make them policies, or you embed them somewhere in the policy, or practices that happen. For example, they talk about when you have a resume that has names that sound like they are foreign-born or minority names, whatever that means, or women, and you look at them and you evaluate resumes. If they're evaluated blindly, they could be the same resume with the names different, and people evaluate the underrepresented minorities and the women at a lower level, even though the resumes are the same. So there's studies that talk about that unconscious bias that people have. And some of it's conscious bias. You know, it's overt, right?
Right.
So there are several different things that are going on, and I think we have to approach it at several levels. I mean, there's a report that just came out from the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine that talks about sexual harassment, in the academic science, engineering, and medicine. When we talk about the Me Too movement, this is even something different. This was a project that was going on for a while, and they talk about the high percentages of women students who have experienced sexual harassment or gender harassment as a part of their experience as grad students or undergraduates. And it's not just the kind of overt, really aggressive, egregious things. It's the subtle things that putting up pictures that are not appropriate or making little comments. And so it's a range of things that happen. And I think we need men and women as allies to address these things. First, people need to know that they exist and what they are, and they need to recognize that there's an issue so that when it comes up, they can address it either in a public forum with somebody or privately. You know, hey, guy, you know, you shouldn't have said that. That wasn't nice. Or going to the woman in a case of sexism to say, you know, I understand how you felt, and I want to know that, I want you to know that I support you, and I saw what happened, and you know, you shouldn't be discouraged by that. So there's a lot of different ways that people can work on this issue publicly and privately.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to UMES 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. Today's guest is Dr. Christine Grant from North Carolina State University. Dr. Grant has been talking to us about her upbringing. She's been talking to us about some of the challenges that she's faced as a minority faculty member at North Carolina State University. She's talked about challenges that women in general face in the STEM field. Some other things about Dr. Grant that I find interesting. She's an author. She has a book, Success Strategies for Women in STEM. In the book, she talks about mentoring and the importance of mentorship. She's even received a special honor from the president for her mentorship. So, Dr. Grant, can you tell us a little bit about that award you received, and then also talk to us about what you discuss in this book as it relates to mentorship?
Sure. The award that I received is the PAISM Award, the Presidential Award for Excellence in Science, Math, and Engineering Mentoring. And this is an award given by the President of the United States and sponsored by the National Science Foundation. And I received that award in late 2000s, I believe it was around 2008. And essentially, it is an award that celebrates the fact that I've worked in broadening participation in the STEM realm and worked in that for several years, from K-12, pre-college, undergrad, grad, and with faculty. And so we actually got to go to the White House. We received our award and some resources to continue to do that work. I also received the American Association for the Advancement of Science Mentor Award as well. And there's a Senior Mentor Award, and my mentor received that award the same year that I received the Mentor Award, so that was really nice. So the book actually came about because I actually reached out to Shirley Jackson, who was the president of RPI, first African American woman to get a PhD in nuclear engineering, and she got it from MIT, and she was over the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I had been connecting with her over the years and sent her my resume because I just wanted her to have it. I didn't want anything, and an opportunity came about for her to write a chapter in a book, and she recommended myself, and so I wrote a chapter on mentoring in the first edition of the book, Success Strategies for Women in Science, and we found, it was published by Elsevier Academic Press, and we found that the men were using the book as well, and it wasn't just science, it was STEM as well. And so the second edition, I'm the co-editor with Peggy Pritchard out of Canada, and essentially we have 12 chapters, and there are subjects on mentoring, climbing the ladder, leadership, social media, using social media in STEM fields, and it's written by a group of different women from Canada, Australia, the U.S., and it's basically a primer. You can pick it up, read a chapter, and say, oh, I want to learn about climbing the ladder. Let me read that chapter. So there's standalone, and there are vignettes in there as well. So that's been a lot of fun, and I've had an opportunity to speak and do seminars and workshops as a part of my own consulting to promote success strategies from women in STEM.
Okay. And Dr. Grant is also going to be starting a new podcast. And I know one of the things that you talk about in the podcast is resilience. So for our listeners who may not be interested in STEM at all, you know, they may be in some other field or, you know, maybe they didn't have the opportunity to go to college. How would you say your podcast can help them, or, you know, how can they be resilient? How can they overcome challenges and be empowered and live their best life?
So the interesting thing is that resilience is something that we all have. Everybody has resilience at different levels, and it's just a matter of, do you want more resilience or not? And so when I think about STEM resilience, I think about myself. I think about my mother, what she endured. I think about the hidden figures, Christine Darden, who is one of the hidden figures that was featured in the book but wasn't in the movie. I've had an opportunity to get to know her. We're hoping to have her as a guest on our podcast. She's going to be getting an honorary degree from NC State in a few weeks. We're really excited about that. However, it's not just about STEM. It's about anything that you want to do and you want to do better that you have to be resilient at, that you have to be able to stand strong when the winds come and kind of blow you over and you kind of bounce back, or you stand strong. So I think that STEM resilience is an example of resilience overall. So you can learn lessons from the resilience of STEM figures. That's why Hidden Figures was so popular, right? When Margot Shirley wrote the book, it was about women in STEM fields. However, it resonated with a lot of people because that overcoming adversity and moving forward is important to all of us. So what I'm hoping to do with the podcast is to use women and men who have been resilient in STEM as exemplars that will encourage other people to be resilient wherever they are, whether they've gone to college or not. And I'm doing this podcast with Bob Norp, who is did another podcast with us for the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, which is my professional society as well. So I'm really excited about that, and we hope that folks will tune into that as well.
Yeah, so my question is, before we go, I want to know, how can people listen to the podcast? How can they get the book? And is there a website where they could look you up and maybe contact you if they want to ask you some further questions?
Sure. So my website is www.drchristinegrant.com. Folks can contact me through info@drchristinegrant.com. The information about the podcast should be on the website when we start recording. The other thing is that as I mentioned earlier, I do speaking seminars and workshops for organizations, and I do coaching and online webinars and things like that for organizations as well. And so if folks are interested in any aspect of that, whether it's STEM related or not, they should just reach out and contact me through my website.
Right. And then you also have a business as well, right?
Yes. All the information that I just told you was my consulting and my business, which is separate from the university. And it's a Cool Sci Productions LLC, Cool Sci, like Cool Science Productions. LLC is the name of my company. However, the website is drchristinegrant.com.
Right. And ladies and gentlemen, in addition to all of those things that she just told you, she's also married. She has an adult son who is a fairly recent graduate of the University of Maryland College Park in their School of Journalism, and he's really big into sports journalism, and I'm sure you'll be hearing a lot from him in years to come. He may be on ESPN or one of these major sports outlets one day in the future. Her husband's involved in computer science, and yeah, she does quite a bit. She does, and she sings in a church choir too, so she definitely does quite a bit. So Dr. Grant, thank you so much for joining
thank
us
you.
Today, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you, and thank you, listeners, for participating, and continue to listen to the show and be empowered.
Thank you. All right, folks, we are out of time. We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here's when I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that has piqued my interest. For this week's Parting Shots, I want to focus on holiday traditions. Every Thanksgiving, I try to watch the Macy's Parade on NBC. Every Christmas, I try to watch the movie A Christmas Story during TNT's 24-hour marathon broadcast of that film. As I've gotten older, the Macy's Parade has become more background noise for me, but it is still as much of a Thanksgiving necessity as turkey and cranberry sauce. I've probably seen A Christmas Story 100 times, but I still laugh out loud every time I see that kid get his tongue stuck on the frozen flagpole. What traditions do you observe during the holidays? Do those traditions have the same thrill for you as they did when you were younger? Just something to think about. Thanks again for our guest today, Dr. Christine Grant. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and social media. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.
If you would like to hear this or previous episodes of UMES 30, go to our website, WESM913.org, access the news drop-down menu, and click Education.